I go, I'm asked if I think the universities stifle writers. My opinion is that they don't stifle enough of them. There's many a bestseller that could have been prevented by a good teacher. That's a comment by Southern writer Flannery O'Connor, who died in 1964 at the age of 39 of complications of lupus, the same autoimmune disease that had claimed her father's life 2 decades earlier. What is lupus? Who gets it? And what can be done about it? I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
In a disease like lupus, what makes the body start attacking itself? How much more common is lupus among women and African Americans? How does a doctor diagnose lupus? And what sort of treatment is available once that diagnosis occurs? Joining us for these and other questions is Dr. Kevin McCown, rheumatologist in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Oh, thank you.
Lupus, it's the first thing I have to ask about is the name. It's sort of a curious name. I realize it's a very curious disease or battery of diseases too. But what does that name mean? Where does that come from?
Well, it's an old name actually from over 1,000 years ago. Apparently, any type of rash where there was damage or erosion to the skin was called lupus. And by lupus, they meant it looked like the bite of a wolf.
Ooh, okay. So already we're getting to a little bit of a folkloric origin.
So how would you define lupus if somebody just said, so what is lupus?
Well, unfortunately, lupus really doesn't have an easy way to be described. If I were to describe it to you or to a doctor in the most accurate way I could, I'm sure you would walk away and have no idea of how to identify lupus if somebody with lupus saw you. But we really think that it's one of the prototypic autoimmune diseases. That is a disease where the body's immune system, instead of attacking invaders, is attacking itself.
And what are some of the other autoimmune diseases then? Because we think of, what, multiple sclerosis mm-hmm. and some of the others. How do you sort of separate out lupus?
Not to mention AIDS.
Well, there are sort of two broad ways that you could categorize autoimmune disease. There are some that are more or less limited to certain organs. So, for instance, juvenile diabetes or type 1 diabetes is a condition where the immune system is attacking the pancreas. Most people who have low-functioning thyroid glands have had an autoimmune attack on their thyroid gland. And there's a number of these other examples. But in terms of what we call rheumatic disorders, these tend to be conditions where the body's immune system is attacking more generally and can affect tissues throughout the body. Probably the most common autoimmune condition would be rheumatoid arthritis.
That is another word that seems a little confusing. What exactly is rheumatoid, rheumatism?
Well, rheumatism really doesn't mean very much.
This is a very slippery disease we're talking about here.
It's probably something that your grandparents had. Part of the problem with this is that even going back into the annals of medicine, it wasn't too long ago where doctors who were studying these disorders really had very little ability to make distinctions between the different types of conditions. But rheumatoid arthritis now is a well-defined autoimmune condition where the body's immune system basically attacks the joints and destroys them. However, it also does have effects on other parts of the body as well. Lupus is a type of autoimmune condition that can affect the joints, but it tends to affect other parts of the body more so even than the joints.
So to be diagnosed as having lupus as opposed to multiple sclerosis, gout, all these other connective tissue things and so on, I mean, as you're sort of trying to separate out the symptoms, what do you look for most?
Well, unfortunately, there is no one set of symptoms or things that we can find on examination or even test that's going to say you do or don't have any type of autoimmune disease, or you do or don't have a particular type of autoimmune disease. I kind of liken it to putting together pieces of a jigsaw puzzle and trying to decide how the pieces best seem to fit together. However, when we're putting together this puzzle, we don't really know what the puzzle is going to look like when we get done. So that obviously makes it more challenging. We don't really know if we're actually trying to put together pieces of several puzzles, because people can have symptoms that may be autoimmune, they may have other symptoms that may not be of autoimmune nature.
Well, so with this famous writer, Flannery O'Connor, that I started with, who always in all the biographies mm-hmm. it says she died of lupus, as did her father. Is it for sure then that she had lupus, or is it just likely based on her symptoms?
You know, I'm not that familiar with her symptoms, but that was around the time that people really started getting better at diagnosing lupus. Really, lupus had been described in the early 1800s in a way that we could recognize, I think, from this point in time, that they were really talking about lupus. But it was only the late 1800s where people started thinking about lupus as being more than a skin disease, as being more of a disease that could affect all parts of the body. By the mid-40s, we were really starting to get a good ability, I think, in most cases, to identify people who had really severe disease. And then in the late 40s is when this idea of autoantibodies really came into being, that we could identify that these were autoimmune diseases. And from that point on, then we really started getting much better about being able to diagnose lupus.
I see Michael Jackson attributed to having lupus. On the other hand, I saw sort of a back diagnosis going all the way back to Louisa May Alcott. So I wonder if there's not some medical sleuthing going on in her case. But what is the most certain way of saying it? Is it a blood test? I mean, is it something that actually can chemically determine this is a form of lupus?
Well, there are something called classification criterion that have been published. And these criterion are basically sort of a list of different symptoms, different findings on physical exam, and different laboratory tests. And if you have a certain number of them, then you would be classified as having lupus. Now, if you meet that classification criterion, you probably have lupus, but it still doesn't mean it's 100%. So like in many aspects of medicine, what we're dealing with is probabilities. So if you meet this classification criterion, there'd be a very high probability that you have lupus. But really the surest way, I guess, to be confident that that's what a person has is just seeing what happens over a period of time. Because in many cases, it may take even years before it's clear that this person has lupus and not some other condition that could mimic some of the features of lupus.
It seems like an obvious answer to this question in a way, and yet are there other diseases that we talk about in the same way, something like, what, fibromyalgia or something that is this sort of vague combination of symptoms and situations?
Well, almost all the diseases that rheumatologists see, beyond the most simple things like the osteoarthritis, which is the common age-related type of arthritis, or gout or infections, almost all the other diseases, even rheumatoid arthritis, really are all what we call clinical diagnoses, meaning that there aren't any specific tests that will say with 100% clarity and certainty that you have it or that you don't have it.
And how widespread is lupus or
whatever we think it is?
Lupus, because, you know, we hear about these different diseases, whether it's Parkinson's or MS or this thing or that thing. And I guess I don't have a sense of how many people get lupus, how big a problem it is.
Well, it is a big problem. You know, lupus roughly affects probably 1 out of 2,000 people in the United States. I say roughly because we really don't have, you know, ideal studies that would really answer that question with certainty. A lot of it is going to depend upon the racial mix of the population that you look at, the age of the people that you're looking at, and most importantly, the gender of the people you're looking at. So, for instance, women are much more likely to have lupus and autoimmune diseases in general than men will.
Any thought on why?
Well, there's lots of thoughts about why that is, and this is actually true in animals as well. If you look in animals, female animals are more likely to have autoimmune diseases, and probably in a very simple-minded way, you can kind of say that may be the price to pay for having more aggressive immune systems, because it appears that female animals are more resistant to infection.
As a way of protecting the young or whatever, perhaps?
Or protecting the mother while having the young.
And so this aggressive immune system then that is meant to attack invaders somehow goes wrong?
Yeah, I think that's just – whether or not that's truly accurate, I don't think anyone can say, but that's probably sort of a way that seems to make sense of why women might be more prone to having this. It's just that that balance between not having autoimmunity and not having a robust enough immune system, you know, is just a little bit – you have to pay the price, I guess, in a sense that the price you pay for having a more effective immune system in fighting off aggressors is that it's more likely to end up attacking the self.
Statistically, then, who is most at risk for coming down with lupus? I mean, women, but – what other aspects of the population?
Well, women of childbearing age in particular is where we're going to see the highest risk. So women in their teens, 20s, 30s. African-American women probably have 2 to 3 times the risk of Caucasian women in North America and Europe. The numbers aren't as clear-cut, but Hispanic women certainly seem to have an increased risk, probably intermediate between that of Caucasians, individuals of Northern European descent, and those people whose ancestors came from Africa.
Do you find lupus more common within families?
Lupus definitely does appear to be more common in families. We think that a large part of lupus is genetic in its nature. There's not a single gene. There may be 4 to 8 or more genes that may be involved in the development of lupus in any one individual. And those genes may actually be different in different people. And some of that may explain some of the racial differences that we can see with lupus. If you look at identical twins, probably there's a 1 in 5 to 1 in 2 chance that if one twin has lupus, then the other one will. And so that really confirms to us that genetics does play an important role in the development of lupus. But it also tells us that there has to be an environmental component, because you could have no more than half of those twins, even though they're identical genetically, are going to develop lupus.
Do you find, you mentioned that it mostly targets women of childbearing ages, but do you find lupus in children?
Lupus can occur in children. Yep, it's less common, but it can occur in children. It can occur in elderly individuals as well. Again, it's just less common.
You sometimes marvel that it's diagnosed at all. It's so amorphous and so well disguised in some ways.
Well, it can take a while to diagnose, and thankfully, the cases that take longest usually take longer because they tend to be fairly mild. When people really have severe life-threatening lupus, it's usually much more obvious that that's what's going on.
On the website for the American Lupus Foundation, they mentioned that the most common misconception about lupus is that it's always fatal. You know, that there's this sort of scary thing that happens when people hear lupus, that they assume it's going to be automatically a killer. What other kind of misconceptions do you think people have about lupus, where they might hear the name and sort of have the wrong impression? Just from what, you know, there's a lot of pop medicine out
right
here on the internet and so on.
Well, one thing that I know is out there is a lot of information that you can see in magazines that will list the different symptoms of lupus. And, for instance, they'll talk about fatigue. And it's true that almost everyone with lupus will be fatigued, certainly if the lupus is active. However, probably if you polled the general population, probably about 80% of us are fatigued, and probably most of us are of that 80% are just not getting enough sleep. So I think that there are many common symptoms that can be symptoms of lupus but are much more likely to be due to other things.
Which, again, makes it harder to identify. So what would make me want to go in and get diagnosed to see if I have lupus? So at what point would I say, well, yeah, I'm fatigued, so what? But what else? I mean, a rash or
definitely
what's the telltale?
I think if you have a rash, particularly rashes that you don't know what it's due to, you know, you haven't been in poison ivy lately or something like that. Lupus rashes tend to be in sun-exposed areas, but not always. But I think any time a person would have a rash and they didn't know what it was due to and it was persisting, that they should see their doctor. Another common reason for people that people should go to the doctor would be if they start developing joint pains. And most of the time, the joint pains in lupus will tend to be in the hands, knees. So just because you have joint pain doesn't mean you're going to have lupus. You probably are not.
But if you have joint pain and the rash,
well,
and the fatigue.
Either one, I would say, would be reason enough to go in to see your primary care doctor. There are more unusual and severe things that I think would cause anybody to go in to see their doctor, things like shortness of breath or chest pain, fevers. Unfortunately, lupus can present with many symptoms, and so really I think I wouldn't encourage people to try to diagnose themselves so much as to say, you know, maybe I should go in. And if lupus is something you've read about and worried about, you know, bring that up with your doctors. Say, you know, this is something I'm concerned about. Could this be lupus?
Let's look at some of the possible triggers of lupus when we return in a moment. This is University of the Year.
My youngest daughter was nearly 6 months old at the time. I awoke one morning unable to move a single muscle. God, what is happening to me? After many doctor's visits and numerous tests and scans, I was diagnosed with lupus. "What is that?" I asked my doctor, and before I knew it, the tears began to flow like a floodgate opened. All I remember hearing was, "You can live a healthy life if you are willing to change your life." That's a description of lupus by Rosalind Jones Knight, a student in the UW Odyssey Project. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Dr. Kevin McCown, and we're talking about lupus. Well, we talked about how there is a genetic component and how it is also more common among some races than others. But you also mentioned that there are environmental triggers, things that seem to act as a on switch. What are some of those things that are thought to have made lupus start?
Well, unfortunately, we don't usually know what those triggers are. We just know that there have to be those triggers because, as I mentioned, if you could have two people who are identical genetically, that is, identical twins, and they don't both get lupus most of the time. So some of the triggers that we're looking at and there is evidence for, first off, would be infections. And some of these infections may be sort of the last triggering pathway. Some of them may actually be infections that the body is having trouble controlling. There's some evidence that people who have lupus have difficulty controlling Epstein-Barr virus, which is the virus that causes mononucleosis. And essentially all of us will sometime in our life, usually early on in our life, will be infected with Epstein-Barr virus, and our body's immune system will keep it under control, and it'll just stay with us indefinitely. But there is some growing evidence that people with lupus may have trouble controlling this virus, and that may be one of the factors that may actually down this persistent viral infection that's not controlled may be one of the factors driving the development of lupus.
So one of the twins might have gotten a virus?
Yeah.
Maybe a different
virus or even a different stage in life, because there may be differences in triggering events depending on other factors in life. So for instance, estrogen seem to be important because if you look at the differences in men and the rate at which men and women develop lupus prior to puberty, it's probably about 3-1 female to male. During the reproductively active years, it's probably more like 10-1 female to male. And then after menopause, later in life, it's probably more 2-1 or 3-1 again. So estrogens do seem to play a role. There is some evidence that the use of estrogen-containing oral contraceptives and estrogen replacement therapy post-menopause will increase the risk for lupus. There's some evidence that sunlight can certainly trigger lupus, ultraviolet light.
You mentioned that the rash, for example, mm-hmm. tends to be in some exposed areas.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
You mean more sunlight will be more likely? Somebody who's out in the sun might get it more often?
Well, what we can say is that individual episodes of lupus in some individuals are very clearly triggered by being in the sunshine. Whether a lifetime difference in sun exposure is going to predispose to lupus, I don't know that we can say. In fact, there's some evidence that people with low levels of vitamin D, and vitamin D is something that we get from the sun, may be at increased risk for having lupus.
And so damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Well,
this is a tough one to fight.
It comes down to all things in moderation, I think. Certainly avoiding excessive sun exposure and sunburns is important for many reasons. The amount of sun exposure that's required to make vitamin D for most of us is about, who are light-skinned, would be about 20 minutes on your hands and arms 3 days a week.
What are some of the diseases that can mimic lupus?
Or vice versa?
Yeah.
Well, there are many diseases that could mimic different aspects of lupus. Early on, one of the big questions that we can have is this just a virus? Because viruses can cause symptoms throughout the body, can cause rashes, joint pains, fevers, can even cause some of the blood tests that we think about as being typical of lupus. They can become positive with viral infections. There are some chronic viruses that don't go away. Some of the hepatitis viruses, like hepatitis C, for instance, can mimic many aspects of lupus. HIV would be another infection. There are some more rare bacterial infections, chronic bacterial infections, such as tuberculosis could do that. And then there are many individuals who will just have a variety of symptoms which you could say, they have this test that's typical of lupus, but in fact it may be due to something else. Or they have this fatigue, which is typical of lupus, but it may be due to something else.
So how long a watching period would be necessary typically to say, well, we can rule out this, this, and this, so it's probably lupus.
Usually viruses will resolve within a year, unless it's a chronic viral infection. Some individuals we're pretty sure have a systemic autoimmune disorder, but it doesn't seem to be full-blown in the way that we think about being able to tell somebody, yeah, you definitely have lupus. And in those individuals, sometimes 5 or 10 years or sometimes more can go by, and then finally they will clearly have lupus. In many cases, however, they just get better or stay the same. So it's really hard to put a definite number on that.
So let's say I come into the office and I have achy joints, fatigue, a rash, swollen joints, and so on. And you're trying to figure out, do I have lupus? What are some of the tests, some of the procedures that would be used in order to make what I guess would be as good a diagnosis mm-hmm. as you can so that we can then move to treatment?
Well, even before the test, there'd be some probably specific questions or examination that would be done that would be looking for things that you might not have even noticed that might be highly suggestive of some sort of autoimmune disease going on. In terms of testing, there are some very common tests like a complete blood count, which in people who have lupus will often be abnormal in some of the components, like the white blood count may be low, the red blood count could be low, something called platelets can be low. We also look at kidney function and look at the urine analysis, look at the urine to see if there's any unusual amount of protein in the urine. All of these could be indicators of lupus that a person really wouldn't be aware of for the most part. Almost everybody who has lupus will have a test called an ANA. That's an anti-nuclear antibody test. So somewhere around 98% of people with lupus will have this test. The problem with the test is that almost everybody who has a positive test doesn't have lupus. So
you're in a frustrating area of medicine, I think,
so you
in some ways.
You do have to have a certain level of patience to be a rheumatologist, that's for sure.
Once you finally have figured out this person has lupus, and it could be anywhere from, what, 1 to 10 years that it takes you to figure this out, is lupus a disease such that after 10 years it's going to probably get worse? I mean, is in a sense, is that kind of a lost cause by the time you diagnose it?
Well, in some ways, it's not even essential that we say, I know for sure that you have lupus or not. Because if we're fairly confident that people have a autoimmune disorder, the treatment is much the same. So there really isn't a specific treatment at this point in time for lupus. What we do is mostly treat symptomatically. There is one drug called hydroxychloroquine, which originally was an anti-malaria medicine, but it's a drug that we found seems to have benefits for many individuals who have systemic autoimmune diseases. And the hydroxychloroquine clearly will reduce symptoms like rash and arthritis. There's actually some pretty good data to suggest that it reduces the number and severity of flare-ups. It may actually even slow progression in those people who we suspect may be at risk for developing lupus to actually go on and develop full-blown lupus. So that's something that we can treat without even saying, yes, you do, or no, you don't have
lupus. Just treat it as you would any of the autoimmune
Correct.
Diseases.
Yep.
You mentioned flare-up, and one thing I've noticed among the students I have with lupus is they'll say, my lupus is acting up, or my lupus is flaring up. Can you explain that?
Well, lupus is a disease which for most people isn't uniformly active. And when we say active, that when people talk about activity, they're talking about symptoms. And when doctors talk about activity, they're talking about not only symptoms but also blood test abnormalities or abnormalities on physical exam. So lupus tends to have periods where people may do very well. They may feel completely normal. If they're fortunate, they may go into periods of remission that may last even years. But unfortunately, usually at some point, they're going to have a flare-up again where they'll start becoming sick again, start having symptoms again.
Any thought on what triggers the flare-ups?
Sometimes it's very clear that it's something like exposure to sunshine. For some people, that's just a predictable sort of trigger. Other times, infections can be triggers. There may be sometimes some drugs. We tend to steer people away from sulfa drugs because it seems that those may cause flares of lupus sometimes.
Other than sunlight, what behavior modifications would be called for in a person diagnosed with lupus?
Well, we certainly want people to remain as physically active as possible. We want them to eat a heart-healthy diet because people with lupus do have an increased risk for heart disease. And other than that, we really try to encourage them to find ways to, you know, lead as normal a life as they feel like they can, which for many people, the experience of many people is that they do well most of the time.
Any evidence that stress increases the flare-ups?
Stress is a hard thing for us to measure, obviously. There are some measurable effects that stress has on the immune system, and certainly there are people who attribute their flares to stress. I think stress may or may not turn out to be scientifically proven to have some sort of role in causing flare-ups, but certainly, as with anyone else, we do counsel people to try to find ways to reduce stress in their life and deal with stress.
I wonder if this is one of the diseases that sometimes has been the case where women in the past would go to the doctor with symptoms that then would be sort of dismissed as hysteria or nerves or something, because especially if it's in this kind of inchoate, you know, not sure what it is area, I wonder if there were a lot of women in the past that, you know, didn't get diagnosed for that reason.
Well, I'm sure that's the case. I'm sure there are women now, hopefully not very many, but it is something I think that people who are concerned about whether they have lupus or not, they need to make sure that those concerns are being appropriately addressed.
I assume since there are so many aspects, so many components to lupus, that there would be more than one drug, more than one approach to it.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And one of the important things in treating lupus is to make sure that the treatment really fits which the manifestation of lupus that you're trying to address. As an example, there are manifestations of lupus which can be very problematic, even disabling for people, which are not life-threatening. And so for those types of manifestations, things like the arthritis and the rash, we're going to start out with drugs that have less riskiness to them. For some people, lupus can be a life-threatening condition, particularly if it involves the brain or the kidneys, and less commonly the heart and lungs.
How does it involve the brain?
Well, the basis for all of these problems in lupus is that these autoantibodies that normally should be, or the antibodies that normally should be attacking invaders, is going to be attacking parts of the body. In some cases, these antibodies will directly damage cells. In other cases, they will combine with other cellular debris and material in the bloodstream and then be deposited in other tissues like in the kidney or in the brain. And then that deposition of what we call immune complexes actually will incite an inflammatory response in those tissues.
So if it affected the brain of someone, how would that show up in the form of symptoms?
Well, some of the milder symptoms might be things like headaches. The more severe things could be seizures, coma, stroke.
And so let's say you're treating the achiness. You had mentioned the hydroxychloroquine mm-hmm. is a general one, the antimalarial one that would help with some of the symptoms and possibly even slow the disease. But what are some of the other treatments for, say, the achy, the joint problems, you know, some of the things?
The other things that we would try for individuals who are having those sorts of symptoms would be medicines like ibuprofen and naproxen that, you know, we could even start out with over-the-counter doses, and if those didn't work, then we could go to prescription strengths. For people who are having a lot of symptoms, we can try low doses of steroids like prednisone. And the nice thing about prednisone is that it acts very quickly compared with some of these other drugs. The hydroxychloroquine is a much safer drug than steroids would be, but it can take weeks to work.
Now, why would steroids work? I know we hear about athletes sometimes taking them. How is what works for an athlete who's cheating also somehow related to treating lupus?
Well, they're really not the same thing. What the athletes are getting are what are called anabolic steroids, or they're androgens, basically, so male hormone. And the type of steroids that we're treating patients with lupus with are what are called corticosteroids. So they're stress-related hormones that are produced when people are in stressful situations normally. So they're not really in many ways, they have some opposing actions.
And why would they help with an autoimmune disease if you get this stress hormone? How does that work?
Well, because What happens is that these hormones will actually dampen the immune system. Normally, when we have an infection, we certainly want the immune system to kick in and wipe out that infection. But the body also has to have a way of turning that process off, because if it doesn't, the inflammation could damage the body. And so cortisol production is a natural – it has many actions, but it's sort of a natural way that the body starts turning off the appropriate immune responses when they occur. And so when people have lupus, they have this inappropriate immune response that's going on all the time against their own body. We can utilize the same sort of hormone that the body produces to turn off this abnormal immune response.
To turn off just the abnormal one? There's no risk of turning off the healthy part of the immune response?
Well, unfortunately, there's a great risk in doing that. Corticosteroids are remarkably effective, but they're also quite dangerous, particularly if used in high doses or for long periods of time. And in the short run, in high doses, actually the major risk is just what you mentioned, and that is getting other types of infections.
It also seems to make people sort of puffy. Why is that?
That puffiness is really due to deposition of fat. So it's certainly cosmetically a very big problem for a lot of people, but there are many, many other serious health concerns that come with the use of steroids on a regular basis. And so that's one of the reasons that we really look for other things rather than these corticosteroids in treating lupus.
So as far as this rash is concerned, which is one of the hallmarks of lupus, I take it that's not a topical treatment for that. There has to be something more systemic.
Well, sometimes people do benefit from topical treatment. Actually, one of the more effective ones for many people is just avoiding the sun, but that can be a difficult thing to do.
And then your vitamin D level would drop.
Right. For people who have systemic lupus, often there are symptoms other than just the rash. And so even if we were able to be fully effective in treating the rash topically, then we'd still need to make sure that we were addressing any sort of systemic inflammation or more widespread inflammation.
I saw on the lupus site that it said the full name of the disease is SLE, systemic lupus, I don't know how to pronounce it, erythematosus?
Erythematosus.
Okay. What does the erythematosus mean?
Red.
Red. Okay.
Finally, a straightforward, simple answer.
Keeping those scientists employed for generations.
That's right.
Lingo like that.
More on red lupus when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Kevin McCown, who is a rheumatologist with the UW Department of Medicine and University Hospital. And the topic is a very tricky one, even I think for physicians. Lupus, it's a hard thing to diagnose and it looks like a lot of other things sometimes. And it also, I guess, can mimic other diseases as well, so it's hard to diagnose and even the treatment can be a little tricky. But once we've determined that somebody really has lupus and it's an ongoing case, what kind of prognosis do they have? A chance for recovery, for not recovering?
Well, for most people, lupus is a lifelong disorder, and that's obviously a very difficult thing, particularly if you're talking about those people most affected. They're going to be young women, people really who are coming into the prime of life. And really, I think it's a huge shock and a huge adjustment for many people to come to terms with the idea that they have something that most likely is going to be a lifelong condition for them. The good news is that individuals with lupus are doing much better in terms of quality of life and even longevity than they were in years past. So in the 1950s, the survival at 10 years was probably about 50%. Currently, in most series of patients, it's above 90%.
For 10 years.
For 10 years. Some of that change may be due to the fact that we're probably better at diagnosing lupus, so we're including more of the milder cases. But we think a lot of it is due to the fact that we're providing better treatment for the lupus, and just as importantly, we're actually providing general medical care.
If you see a phrase like I did with O'Connor where it said died of complications of lupus, is it usually that somebody has kidney failure or heart failure? In a real severe case of lupus, what is it that usually happens in terms of the order of events?
Well, if we look at when people who have lupus die and we try to look at the reasons why, if you look early on, that is in the first 5 or 10 years, it tends to be due to either the lupus itself or, unfortunately, due to infections, which are largely caused by our treatments. We're trying to suppress this abnormal immune response, and as you picked up on, unfortunately, that's going to leave people open to other types of infections. So we really are trying to find ways to better fine-tune our treatment so that it's really only affecting the abnormal immune response. Of those people who tend to die due to the lupus, probably the biggest single problem is kidney involvement. And so that's one of the things that we really like to monitor on a regular basis. Even if people don't feel like they're having any problems, we still like to monitor their kidney function on an ongoing basis to make sure that they don't have a brewing inflammation in the kidneys.
And that's because the kidneys process waste and we have this sort of leftover matter from the infections?
Basically, it's probably more that so much of the blood flow goes through the kidney, that these immune complexes, these big conglomerations of these autoantibodies and their targets get stuck in the kidney and they get deposited in the kidney. And then the immune response comes along and recognizes this as a problem, creates inflammation to try to kind of get rid of that deposit material and causes the damage to the kidney itself.
What happens if you have a damaged kidney? I mean, in terms of what the patient would experience?
Typically, people don't have any symptoms other than perhaps feeling fatigued. And that's why it's really important that we do monitor blood tests and urine tests to make sure that the kidney function appears to be normal.
But I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, we know that if something's wrong with your heart, you tend to have a heart attack. Your heart
right.
stops.
Right.
So if you have sort of the equivalent of a kidney attack.
Renal failure.
And if you have renal failure, what is it that then presents in the examining room?
People really don't generally have very many symptoms unless things are really advanced, in which case they just may feel very unwell, may lose their appetite, their blood pressure may go up. Occasionally, they may notice some blood in the urine, although that's unusual. So really, that's one of those things that we just have to keep an eye on with the test.
So after the kidneys, then what else do you start seeing in the case of sort of late stage lupus?
Well, later on, in general, most of the excess mortality that we see with lupus comes from heart disease and cardiovascular disease. So people who have lupus seem to be much more prone to developing these problems like heart attack and stroke. Some studies have suggested that women who have lupus are 8 times more likely to have a heart attack or a myocardial infarction than women of their age who don't have lupus. And that's really dramatic considering that cigarettes only double your risk. And here's this lupus that increases your risk 8 times.
What if you smoke and have lupus? Does that increase it? Or
That's a bad combination.
Yeah. All right, so we got the kidneys and the heart. What else?
Well, the brain can be affected, and obviously that can be a serious thing if it's severely affected. Involvement of the lung can be very common, causing inflammation of the lining of the lungs, and people have chest pain when that happens. It's called pleurisy, so it hurts when you take a deep breath. People can get pleurisy for other reasons, too, if you have a virus or something, but that's probably the most common lung involvement in lupus. Fortunately, it's uncommon to have any type of serious lung problems with lupus.
As far as future research is concerned, you mentioned that animals can get lupus.
That's true. And one of the things that's helped us to understand human lupus better is to looking at animal models of lupus so that we can actually look at the effects of having certain genes that are turned on or turned off. We can look at the effects of different hormone levels, like of female versus male hormone levels. So the animal models have been very useful in helping us understand really what's going on with lupus and helping us think about ways that we might be able to target the condition more effectively with treatments.
I assume that rats then would be, and maybe mice would be a choice animal for study?
Yeah, it's primarily rodents and actually just particular strains. Just like in humans, there are certain genetic backgrounds upon which it's common to develop lupus. And in other genetic backgrounds, those animals seem to be resistant to developing lupus.
Do you think with more worldwide attention to lupus, the way there has been, say, with AIDS, that there might be information to be gleaned from which populations? I mean, maybe I've just been missing it, but I haven't seen much about lupus in Africa, lupus in other regions of the country, and trying to look at why certain populations have it more than others.
That's a very interesting question. Clearly, if you look in North America and Europe, people whose ancestors came from Africa are 2 to 3 times higher risk for developing lupus. when we look at people who live in Africa, it's not clear that they do have much lupus. Now, one of the questions is it just because they don't have the public health infrastructure or the clinical infrastructure to diagnose it, even if it's there? And that's certainly a possibility. Another possibility would be, is there something about living a Western life that is going to make some individuals more prone to developing lupus?
Like diabetes, the way that'll hit maybe someone who's a Native American who eats a Western diet?
Correct.
That kind of
thing?
Yeah. Any evidence that diet affects lupus?
There's not very much. There was one dietary supplement that is derived from alfalfa sprouts that actually has caused what's called a drug-induced lupus. This is a situation where people develop some of the symptoms of lupus, but then it goes away completely when the drug is withdrawn. And so there, some alfalfa tablets basically have been implicated in a few human cases and actually in some animal models of lupus as well. In general, a Western diet that's high in calories and high in fat probably tends to increase the amount of inflammation that goes on in the body. And so in general, if you look at autoimmune conditions and people go on to a lower fat or a vegetarian diet, they tend to have less inflammation going on. But we don't really have a lot of evidence that that has much to do with whether people get the disease in the first place or not.
What do you think the next breakthrough is going to be?
Well, I'm actually hoping that in terms of diagnosis, we're going to be able to start looking at arrays of genes and look at patterns of gene activation or deactivation. And so there are methods that are present in the laboratory that I think are going to be coming into the clinical arena in the next few years that are going to really allow us to look at tens, if not hundreds, of genes at one time. And I think by doing this, we're going to be able to have a better idea of whether people really do have lupus or not. And we're hoping that we're going to find more targeted therapies. And in rheumatoid arthritis, we've had a dramatic improvement in the treatment of patients through the use of drugs that will target certain chemicals called cytokines that are involved in inflammation. And although we haven't cured rheumatoid arthritis yet, we've dramatically improved people's quality of life, and there's some evidence that we're improving their life expectancy through these new medications. And I think all the rheumatologists in the U.S. and around the world are hopeful that one or more of the many new, more targeted therapies that are currently being studied will provide us with the same sort of breakthrough that we've seen in rheumatoid arthritis.
Do you think it's possible that there's actually a spectrum of diseases that are right now all being called lupus but would be sorted out into maybe four or five different diseases?
Well, I think that's quite likely. Even in rheumatoid arthritis now, there's increasing evidence that there are two major types that are quite different in their course, in their prognosis. And these types were being defined by a blood test, which has really only been in use for the last half dozen years. So I think there's a good likelihood that in lupus we're going to be able to do this in the future, make a similar sort of distinction.
Well, the student whose comment I opened with that was talking about, you know, crying when she learned she had lupus, she goes on to write, "I've had 5 major surgeries due to some form of complication from my lupus. For me, living with lupus is adaptation to things you would otherwise know nothing about if you weren't faced with it. Early on, this disease came close to taking me out. I couldn't fathom the idea of me being sick the rest of my life." But then she goes on to say that she, after questioning why me, decided why not you, and says, "From that moment on, I began to embrace this thing called lupus as a part of me now." So let's say you have someone like this who is embracing lupus. It is a part of her. What would you say to her and to others with it to do as they go into their future? What is it that they should be especially vigilant about?
Well, first of all, I think really confronting the reality of having that condition is the most important thing. When we look at people's outcomes, one of the strongest predictors of a poor outcome is the person who is unable to accept that they have this condition. They don't come in for regular monitoring. They don't take their medications, and they just don't do so well. So I think the first thing is to, as she has done, accept that this is the way things are going to be, and then really become a full partner with her doctors in making sure that, you know, she's doing everything she can to keep the disease under control and to live as full a life as possible. And, you know, I would say that most people who have lupus do live happy and fulfilled lives.
It does mean that certain things are going to have to change. For those people where sunlight is a big trigger, that's going to be some major changes in their life, making sure that they really take all the steps necessary to avoid the sun. Because the increased risk for cardiovascular disease is particularly important that they don't smoke, which of course is a major problem in giving up for anybody who's smoking. It's also very important that they remain active, pay attention to their diet, watch their cholesterol and their blood pressure. So it really is something that's going to require a commitment to staying healthy.
But if your father has it or your mother has it, any point in being checked to see if you carry it?
Well, certainly, as we said, that there is some increased risk. In general, for what we'd call first-degree relatives, that is a child of a parent or a brother or sister, it's probably only about maybe 1 in 20. So the risk is not real high. It's certainly much higher than the general populace. I would say for those people that they should not be overly concerned, but just be aware that they are at increased risk so that if they do develop any of these unusual symptoms, that they seek out their doctor's attention, make sure their doctor is aware that there is this family history of lupus.
We've been talking about lupus this hour with Kevin McCown. Thanks for informing us.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and thank you for this opportunity to talk about lupus.
And now we'll hear from a guest who actually has lupus.
Joining us is Daphne Daniels, graduate of the UW Odyssey Project and an outreach specialist with Unity Health Insurance. So you're both a nurse and also a lupus patient, Daphne. Tell us about that.
Well, I was diagnosed several years ago. Actually, the diagnosis was one that was, it's a nonspecific disease process. And it's, you know, you can have a room full of people with the specific diagnosis and none will be the same. You know, it's just like snowflakes falling. You know, it's just that nonspecific. And to my dismay, I have a wonderful rheumatologist, Daniel Muller, who allows me to be myself. He's with the Rheumatology and Immunology Clinic at the UW Hospital. And with that said, as long as I'm allowed to agree to disagree with him, he lets me take control of my own disease process. And with that, it gives me a reason to get up in the morning. And so I haven't had a crisis for several years. But again, that's with my maintenance and working with my rheumatology and immunology doctor.
And what does a crisis actually look like for you? When you did have a crisis, what is it that
happened?
Well,
it presented with many different flare-ups. I had the bone, achy bones, and, you know, the painful, it felt like through systems, starting at the top of my head, it just felt like lights were going off. And the doctor, when I presented in the emergency room, actually told my husband that had I not come in at the time when I did, I may not have made it. I could have possibly died from that particular crisis that I had. There was one lab in particular at that point when I presented that they did, and it was called a sedimentation rate, that it's a nonspecific lab or blood test that was drawn that showed them, well, you need to go and look for other things. Because for years, I had been worked up with different, presenting different things. They thought at one point with my, I presented with eczema, and they thought maybe it was that, and they were doing contraindicated things, giving me ultraviolet treatments, and that was something I shouldn't have had, ultraviolet, give me ultraviolet exposure. I even went as far as to go to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and they couldn't find anything specifically that was wrong with me and sent me home with, you know, the findings of anything in particular. And it wasn't until, again, I had that particular crisis where it was my pulse was clocked at above 140. I had a photosensitivity. I couldn't stand to look at light at that particular time. My organs were beginning, my kidneys and that were beginning to show signs of weakness. And I had chills and fever, and I was in crisis. And after they began to do things to, you know, work on me in the emergency room when I presented, they discovered that that is what was going on with me, I would say, for a good maybe 4 years. And I had, you know, absolutely no idea.
And what's it like living with lupus on a day-to-day basis? What's the routine, if there is such a thing?
Well, you know, sometimes I'm more fatigued than I display. I personally need a reason to get up in the morning, and I kind of push through my day. And for me, I can't speak to, you know, it's like I said, I'm going to have a room full of people presenting with the particular diagnosis, but no two people will you find with it. You know, I maintain my medicine regimen, which is I take a pill called hydroxychloroquine, and that works for me. And I take Diovan, which is, I don't have hypertension. However, I take it so that my kidneys don't work hard because I have a trace. My kidneys are involved mildly because, you know, different organs are affected by it. And I do have the skin involvement as well, the discoid. So those are the three things. And both, again, they are mildly affected. And when I go in to see Dr. Mueller, he checks for the joint and pain disorder. And he says that I'm one of his test cases that he wished that he could, you know, show other patients how to survive and with it. Because, you know, sometimes I'll go in and he'll tell me, you know, if in fact he feels that when examining me that there may be some muscle tightness and that, you know, well, maybe I should put you on steroids. And I'll tell him, no, Dr. Mueller, we're not going to go the steroid route, you know. So he and I have the type of relationship where, again, we can agree to disagree. And I will tell him, you know, this is what works for me and this is what doesn't. So because of the length of time that it took to diagnose and for the length of time that I allowed and was willing to work with and some of the things that happened during the rule out process, I went through a lot. I just decided I wanted to take charge of my life, but still allow my rheumatologist and immunologist to guide me. And with that, since I take his lead, but I still have control. And with that, I have a reason to get up in the morning with the support of my family. And I try to decompress stress. If I relieve the stress from my chest, then, you know, everything works out for my good.
Well, thank you, Daphne, for sharing your story, your courage, patience with the lupus diagnosis.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year. Next Sunday afternoon at 4, join us for University of the Air as David MacDonald is our guest and addresses the question, who is controlling Russia these days? And what are the aims of Russian foreign policy? Join us here on Wisconsin Public Radio.